This is a message by Pastor Mark Fox at Antioch Community Church in Elon, North Carolina. For more information about the church, go to antiochchurchnc.org.
Good morning. Today we will be reading Exodus 3, verses 16 through 22. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, "The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. And I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now, please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give the people, this people, favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but for each woman ask of her neighbor, and any woman who lives in her house, for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians.'"
Thank you, Quinn. Thanks, Brent and worship team. Brent's done some heavy lifting already today as he spoke to us at the men's breakfast about the commandment, "Thou shalt not steal." See what I did there, Brent? See here? No, he's actually spoke on "Thou shalt not bear false witness." And it was great. I hope if you didn't hear it, you'll go back and listen to it. Well, welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome those that are joining us online. Pastor Mark and his extended family are at Holden Beach for their annual trip. And so we wish them well. Hope they have a great week together as a family. And so I'm literally your last choice, or was the last choice to be here. Of those that may remember, last time I was up here, I spoke on immigration. The elders made me sign a contract that I would stick to Exodus 3 here today, so we are doing that, and that's why I'm here speaking to you. But this is a great passage, a great story. I'm so glad we're looking at Exodus. Pastor Mark said last week, I hope you caught it, he said this is one of the most important conversations recorded in all the Bible. And when he said that, I was like, you know, he's exactly right. I mean, it is super important. This conversation between Moses and God, it is referred to a lot, and it's important for Israel's history. It's important for the world history as well. And so we're going through this passage in a very digestible way. If you remember, 3 Sundays ago now, Micah started us on this in talking about a divine encounter with a holy God. And then last Sunday, Mark continued with the part that spoke about God's name and who he is. And we're continuing this today, and we don't even finish it. As the conversation continues next week when Pastor Mark gets back, there's more to this conversation. So it's important, and I think it's right that we're going through this in bite-sized pieces. And before we get into this, I just want to set the stage again. I want to remind us, the bush is still on fire and not being consumed. The angel of the Lord is still in this fire speaking to Moses. Moses is still barefoot. He's taken his sandals off and he is standing on holy ground. Let's remember that as we look into this. And as I read this, when I knew a month ago or so that I was going to be preaching here today, and as I started reading this passage, what struck me in the entire chapter was the number of times God uses the pronoun "I." I counted 14 times in this chapter God said "I." And it really stood out. You know, we humans like to talk about ourselves. right? I mean, it's just, we're bent towards being self-centered. We keep score of our accomplishments, and we can rattle them off with ease. When a famous speaker is being introduced, and somebody's doing that introduction, you notice they have to read from a script, right? You know, so-and-so graduated from this place and whatever, and he has this degree, and he's led this company, and they've made this many millions of dollars, and they're all reading it from a teleprompter or a script. If you introduced yourself for the talk you were going to give, you wouldn't need a teleprompter. You just stay up there and you'd say, I graduated from Elon in 1999, and I got a master's of, or no, I didn't. I got a bachelor's of science in Elon. See, sometimes you got to be reminded, you know. And so you would just spit it off. And some people know their own resume better than others, obviously. You know, when we're shown a picture of a family reunion photo or a school class photo and we're in it, what do we do first? We look for ourselves, right? So we all, you know, remember what we looked like when we had hair and didn't have to wear glasses and those types of things. We're wired that way. When we're in a conversation with others, it's often a repellent for the other person to only talk about themselves and never seem to show interest in you, right? That's a turnoff for us. They teach you in seminars, you can pay good money to go to seminars to learn this one thing, how important it is to genuinely show interest in the other person. The best way to form a great relationship is to show that other person that you sincerely care about them and you're interested in them. And make no mistake, God certainly communicates his interest to us in Scripture. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish. And also, perhaps the culmination is Jesus' own statement. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. God communicates his care for us. But here, he talks about himself. And I don't know about you, but in this instance, it's not a turnoff. It's comforting. It's reassuring. It's inspiring. God, in this encounter, talks all about himself. You know, he's the only entity who can make himself the center of every conversation, and it will always be fully appropriate. Think about that. It's just, when God talks about himself, it's a matter of fact. There's no exaggeration involved. He's not exaggerating something that happened in the history in the past. He's not estimating something that's going to happen in the future like we tend to do. There's no misrepresentation of anything. And so when he speaks about himself, we better listen. Particularly when he uses I as the subject of the sentence, we should zero in on the verbs that follow. And so that's what we're going to do today. Because basically, for the second time in this very chapter, and you could say the third time in the book so far, we're on chapter 3. The second time in this chapter and the third time in this book, God is revealing his plan of what he's about to do in bringing his people out of Egypt. He is summarizing the plot for us once again in the section we're looking at today. So, most of these statements have already been communicated in the first half of this chapter, but we're going to look at it today. There's five. I've broken it up into five. There's actually six times he uses I in here, but I've packaged one together. So there's five I statements here that we're going to look at. The first one is verse 16. He says, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt. Moses is the author of Exodus. He also wrote Psalm 90, and what he wrote in Psalm 90, we know that the life expectancy had already decreased to about 70 to 80 years at this point in time. That means that there was likely five cycles or five generations of people who were born under Egyptian subjugation. They lived every day of their lives under Egyptian subjugation, and they died under Egyptian subjugation. That cycle repeated five times, at least. And we know that it got increasingly harder the further time marched on from the time of Joseph's death. When Moses left Egypt to go into Midian 40 years prior to this point and this experience right now that we're looking at, the normal day-to-day life for the Israelites had become ruthless. Ruthless, hard service, as we learned in chapter 1. This is a long time, 400 years, long time, entire generations of people living as slaves and crying out to their God for rescue, that God would bring them into freedom, and yet there was no deliverance from God. No doubt they questioned if God was still on their side, and perhaps they even questioned if God was still alive. The inaction from God seemed cold and careless. But God says here to Moses that he saw it all. He noted how they were mistreated, how they were beaten unjustly, how they were treated ruthlessly. Even in long periods of silence, God is carefully and meticulously observing what is happening at all moments and in all places. He's taking it all in. Their lives were not ignored by God, and your life is not ignored by God. When Joseph was wrongfully imprisoned for the multiple years that he was in prison, God observed that. When David was in the field tending to the sheep as a young man by himself, God saw the character of his heart. He was observing. When David was on the run from King Saul and hiding out in the deep recesses of the caves, God saw him. When Nathanael was sitting under the tree by himself, Jesus saw him. He used that when he called him. He said, "I saw you under the tree." God was observing it. And the million-dollar question that we've all thought about, most of us have thought about, I know I have, I won't speak for everyone. The million-dollar question, why did God wait 400 years? I think the question God wanted us to know is, can we still trust God while we wait? That's really one of the lessons learned in this 400 for you and I. Can you and I, now we're not going to live 400 years, so we don't have to wait for anything 400 years, but we can wait what seems like a long time in many years. Some of us are waiting on things and have been waiting on things for many years. And can we trust, can we still trust while we wait? You know, I think there's two things that are important for us to keep in mind as we trust while we wait. And perhaps this is some of what God was teaching the Israelites during this 400-year period. Real faith, like real deep internal resolve, builds the most inside of us when we're uncomfortable. Right? There's value and there's satisfaction in going through something that's difficult. The things that we place the highest value on, oftentimes, it was the most difficult for us to get there. We're supposed to go through hard things because it does increase our conviction and our faith as it relates to God. And let's not forget that Jesus himself went through hard things. You know, Jesus is a man of sorrow. He is acquainted with grief. And secondly, an important lesson in learning how to trust while we wait is that there is specific grace for us even under general hardship. I would say it's the lesson of Psalm 13, right? Psalm 13, many of us are familiar with. It says, "How long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long will sorrow fill my heart all day long? How long will my enemy be exalted over me?" Six verses. There are six verses. I just went through four of the six verses. The last two, "But I have trusted in your salvation. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. Right? There's specific grace even in those moments of general hard times. God has specific grace and comfort for us. So perhaps we don't know the full reason. God doesn't need to tell us why they had to wait 400 years. But it wasn't by accident, and we'll see that in just a second. But God doesn't stop with just observing us and then staying on the sidelines, staying inactive. Verse 17, he says, I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction. Here's the unique truth that we must recognize with God, and it's unique because this only applies to God. God's promises and his actions are one and the same. They can't be separated. If he promises to do something, the action, the follow-through may be delayed, but the follow-through is 100%. It's going to happen. Nothing can stop it. So for God, when he promises something, doing it is right there with it. It's a package deal. It can't be divided. It can't be separated. We as humans, we make promises all the time and we leave them unfulfilled. You know, we may make a promise and unintentionally forget to carry it out. Okay? I'm guilty of this all the time. We have a ledge by the door in our house, and so Chrissy sets things on there and she'll say, hey, you're gone to so and so and you're gonna see this and this belongs to them. Can you take it to them? Or you're going over to your mom's, can you get this to them? I'm like, yeah, sure. 20 minutes later, I walk out the house, just leave it on the ledge. I wasn't trying to do that. I just didn't see it, right? Or at that time, I didn't mean to do it. Or even this is even worse. Like sometimes she'll put the trash right outside the door, the trash bag, say, hey, can you get that trash bag to the trash can? You know, you're going to leave in a half hour to go wherever. I'm like, yeah. Half hour comes up, grab my keys, go out, like sometimes step right over the trash or to the side of it, right? Walk out, come home. Oh, that trash bag's there. I said I would take that, you know? And then what's really good is like my sons sometimes do the same thing, you know? And then I've like, at first I'm like, ah, he said he would take the trash cans down to the street, or I asked him to and he said he would, and you know, he's gone now. And then I'm like, well, I do that all the time, right? And so sometimes we just unintentionally forget and don't follow through on our promises. You know, if Chrissy had a dollar for every time that happened, she could go on the vacation of her dreams, I'm sure. Sometimes we don't even take the initial step of faith. Or we might just take a step or two and then we give up, right? This one is like the New Year's resolution pledge to get in shape, right? We buy that gym membership, we go for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we're on our routine. And by the end of January, we've stalled out, right? So sometimes we just don't get very far. We intend to do it, but, and it's not that we've forgotten, it's on our minds, but we just don't exhibit the will or have the discipline to follow through and do it. And then there's other times that we make promises or commitments and we fail because we tried. We gave a best effort and we just came up short. We might make a promise or a commitment to attain a certain level of achievement and give it our best effort and just fall a little short. How many couples stand together in a ceremony and they make a promise to remain together until death does them part, and then various things happen in life and for various reasons they end up separated and divorced? For you and I, we make promises, but the follow-through can be separated from our pledge. It is very much in doubt many times of whether we're going to follow through on that commitment we've made, and therefore many promises go unfulfilled, but not so with God. God said he would bring his people out. And this isn't the first time he declared it, right? We can go all the way back to Genesis 15 when God spoke to Abraham and said, you know, you need to come out from your people. And he did and left. And then they had a conversation and the Lord said to him, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there. and they will be afflicted for 400 years. Well, there you go. There's your answer. Why do they have to wait for 400 years? Because God said it hundreds of years ago at Abraham that this would be a 400-year process in Egypt. The next one, verse 19. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. God knows the beginning from the end. He knows what all of our choices will be in every moment, and he works them together in the course of life to produce the outcomes that he desires. You know, sometimes our desires line up with God's desires, and we respond in obedience, right? Sometimes we do the thing we're supposed to do, and it's easy. That's what we want to do. Other times we still obey, but we've had to wrestle, or God's had to influence us or nudge us, give us a little nudge to follow through and obey. Then there's other times we disobey, right? It's easy to pull a Jonah, right? God tells you to go to Nineveh, and then we get in the boat and go to Tarshish in the opposite direction. Sometimes we just choose to disobey. And through it all, either way, God knows, and he can overcome our responses to work his will. Backing up a little bit in verse 18, notice that Moses, when we start this passage, actually, the command he gives to Moses is to go to the elders and tell them these things. And so in verse 18, he says, and they, that's referring back to the elders of Israel, they will listen to your voice. So see, God knew that when Moses went and said these things to the elders, that they were ready to accept this as best they could. They were ready to receive this, that it was time for them to come out. But he also said he knows that the king of Egypt is not going to listen. He knows it's going to take a mighty display of power to turn Pharaoh's heart around. God knew it was going to take 10 plagues from the very beginning. And he knows our responses to him. And I hope that encourages you today, because what this means, that God knows our responses, is that our responses are his compassion towards us is not dependent on our responses. His love remains unwavering for us. Lamentations 3 says, verse 31 says this, the Lord will not cast off forever, but though he cause grief, he will have compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love. See, God's compassion is not dependent on whether we choose to obey him or disobey him. It's dependent on the abundance of his steadfast love. He has so much steadfast love. I looked up that word steadfast, right? First of all, if you do a search for steadfast, it automatically wants to finish out love. Found that interesting. I started typing steadfast, and it said steadfast love definition. Like, it wasn't separating it, and it was referring to God, steadfast love. We very seldom use the word steadfast, not associated to God, but steadfast means unwavering. It means loyal, right? God's loyal to the love that he has, and he has it in abundance. God's unwavering in the love that he has. And he has that in abundance. This story shows us better than anyone that God does all these things for the Israelites, and yet they still choose to complain. In a short time, they complain, and we'll see that in just a few chapters, about his awesome deliverance, right? They're led out into the wilderness. They escape 400 years of bondage, and God did it in front of their eyes. And in a short time, they're like, food's terrible. Short time, they're like, let's throw our gold together in the middle and make this calf and worship it instead. Yet God's still patient and he's gracious to them. I hope you realize that he's the same with us. The fourth one, I will stretch out my hand. Verse 20. I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it. There's another I, actually. I missed that one. Just called it. So seven times God says I in these passages, this particular passage. I will stretch out my hand and strike it. This is tied to God's promise of bringing the Israelites out. He's revealing what it will take and what he's going to demonstrate to everyone that's watching. Now, this is going to be a faith-building demonstration to the Israelites. God's people have been enslaved for 400 years. They keep crying out, and thus far there's been no action, but they're about to see their God do public things that only he can do. And he's going to do it in front of everybody so they can see it plainly. It's meant to be a memorial of their God's power and their God's love for them forever. The Exodus story is one of the strongest testimonies in the Bible. And by that I mean it is most frequently referred to. Okay, apart from Christ's resurrection, I don't think there's any other historical event that's referred to more in Scripture than the Exodus. There are lots and lots of Psalms written about the Exodus. We're going to see in a few chapters here Miriam's Psalm that's recorded in Exodus about God bringing his people out. Moses has a song in Exodus 2 that's also a Psalm. Stephen, when he's standing in front of the ones that are persecuting him, and he's getting ready to be stoned, the meat of his sermon is about Moses and his Exodus. Paul, when he was standing in front of the emperor of Rome, was talking about the Exodus to the emperor. It's meant to be a memorial for God's people of how much power he has and how much he loves them. But stretching out his hand is also meant to be a faith-crushing experience for the Egyptians. They're going to see that their dependence on anyone or all of the false gods leads to an empty outcome. Imagine putting all your spiritual energies into worshiping things with all your fervor that you think are going to bring you prosperity, only to have that paradigm flipped upside down in just a few days or few weeks and destroyed, where you're like, mercy, uncle, go, leave. You know, it started out well for the Egyptians, right? We're going to see that in a little bit. Their sorcerers and their magic people were able to replicate a plague or two or a mighty act of God or two, but they couldn't stick to it to the end. It was convincing for the Egyptians. Notice God's instruction to Moses in here. He says, you're going to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. That particular verse has always perplexed me when I've read this, because that was never the end goal, right? It was never the outcome. Like, that's not where the direction God was going, was just for this to be a three-day thing and then let's go in. So I've always like, why? Well, thankfully, preparing for this, it makes you dive into it, you know, if you don't take time to look at it at other times. And so when I was looking into to why God had that, I think the best answer I found was that God was using that particular soft ask to reveal the real obstinacy of Pharaoh's heart. Because a secure and a reasonable leader should not hesitate in letting their subjects do this harmless act. Yeah, go out, make a sacrifice to your God, and come back. It was an innocent enough request. But I think God had Moses ask that so that it would be fully revealed how against letting the Israelites go Pharaoh was, how much his thumb was really pressed down upon the Israelites. And it would also set the stage for the extreme wonders that God would perform eventually to wear down Pharaoh's resolve and to release the Hebrews from their captivity. It was setting it up so that there'd be no doubt that God was responsible and the only one who could have freed the Israelites from the power of Pharaoh. The last one is in verse 21. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. This is also a fulfillment of what God revealed and promised to Abraham back in that passage in Genesis 15. We already went over the verse 13, right? They were going to be afflicted for 400 years, but I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. God intended to bless them from the very beginning. In God's kindness, he prepared things so that the Israelites were able to leave Egypt with the Egyptians willingly giving up their own valuable items. And this reality also helped set the Israelites up with some much-needed resources to endure the journey that was before them. Notice the last statement in this passage, "You shall plunder." God used the word plunder here. And when I looked up plunder, you know, it literally means to steal from someone else. If you plunder someone, you just go and steal it, right? But this is a little bit different, because they ask and the Egyptians gave it to them, right? So it's plundered in the sense it was a lopsided deal. Like there was something of value that the Egyptians had, but they didn't get anything back in exchange from it. They just gave it up, right? Israel got something really valuable. The Egyptians did not. It was a terrible deal from their end. And so that's in the sense of the word plunder. That's what God was meaning here. I'd love to see that scene. Like, this would be one I would love to be, like, just hovering above this scene and watch it. Because can you imagine the Hebrews going to their Egyptians' neighbors and saying, "We like that outfit. That'll look good on Johnny. Can we have that one?" You know, it says that they're going to give it to you, the clothes for your children, right? And I like that earrings, those earrings. Can we have that and stuff? "Oh, yeah, sure. Just take it," you know. A remarkable scene. But this scene is also a demonstration of God's justice, that the Israelites left with gold, silver, and clothing from the Egyptians. Remember, God observed the oppression. He said earlier in here, in Micah's passage that he had, where God says, "I see the oppression that the Egyptians have." He saw that the Egyptians used the Israelites to expand their national infrastructure, right? At the beginning of this chapter, it says they were used to build two cities. Or I think at the beginning of the book of Exodus, it says they were used to build two cities. One was Ramses, and I forget what the name of the second city was. But literally, that meant that the Hebrew men had to go and construct this city for a long time and then come back to where their families were, right? And they did that twice over the years, over the generations. And God saw all that the Egyptians were profiting from the Israelites and building cities and roads and all those things, and that there were no personal benefits for them. People ask frequently, is God against slavery? You know, slavery seems to be in the Bible a lot. There's commandments about, if you're a master, this is how you should treat your slave. And if this is your slave, this is how you should relate to your master. So then we're left wondering, okay, does God condone it? Well, we're going to get into that. It's in chapter 21, so I won't jump ahead. But it is in chapter 1 of Exodus, so stick around. We're gonna see what God thinks. But let me tell you right here, since we are here, and state this, that this demonstrates that God is not for oppression by the masters. God's not for unfairly and harshly extracting all the labor that you can out of your slave while not rewarding that slave properly. So in one sense, God's giving his people favor to plunder their Egyptian neighbors, and what that means is it's writing the financial balance sheet in one respect from the labor that the Israelites were forced to give the Egyptians without benefiting at all from it. God will give his people favor. Well, as I said at the beginning, we're not all the way through this encounter that God has with Moses from this burning bush. It will continue next week. But if there's some things for us to take home from this passage, that start with this. When God starts talking about himself, we better pay attention. When God makes a promise, his follow-through can't be divided. And God, in his kindness, knows our responses, still has abundant love for us, still ready to give us favor, as he did with his Israelites here. Let's pray. Lord God, thank you for this encounter, Lord. Thank you for the record of this encounter of yourself with Moses in the wilderness on that day and how it changed the course of human history. Thank you for, Lord, knowing and seeing and hearing and promising and observing and bringing us out and giving us favor. Lord, help us to believe in those things. Lord, help us to trust you as we wait on things, as we wait on you. Help us to see the benefits in waiting, Lord. Thank you for your essence, Lord. Thank you for revealing yourself to your people, to humanity, so that we know who you are, Lord. You are who you are. But we only know it because you've shown us. So we trust in you and ask for greater faith to believe you and what you're capable of doing. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. Antioch Community Church meets every Sunday morning at 10 a.m. at 1600 Powerline Road in Elon, North Carolina. For more information, please go to antiochchurchnc.org.